Journalist and politician Henry Wallace, the 1948 presidential candidate of the Progressive Party, said that, quote, the American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information, unquote. On today's COVID Race and Democracy, we'll take a look at the current information wars, with particular attention to the high-tech monopolies increasing control of the narrative.
This is about big tech being able to decide which voices are heard. And nobody appointed Zuckerberg or Dorsey as the czar of information.
Mickey Huff, director of Project Censored and host of the Project Censored show on Pacifica, discusses algorithmic censorship.
Humanity can't see what is happening to it. And if it can't see what is happening to it, then it can't possibly change what is happening to it. It's a kind of a fake news apocalypse.
In 2017, imprisoned whistleblower Julian Assange warned that high-tech algorithmic perception management could eliminate human agency.
My imprisonment had two reasons. There's a real hidden reason, and that's the song I released about reconciliation.
In a long-standing form of censorship, the Rwandan government summarily executed Rwandan gospel singer Kizito Mihigo for recording a song about reconciliation between Rwanda's Hutu and Tutsi ethnicities. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Diablo Valley College history professor, Project Censored director, and host of the Project Censored show on Pacifica. Mickey Huff, what has been the fate of your critical media literacy conference of the Americas held last fall, and then, as I understand it, disappeared from the YouTube?
Indeed, it did, Anne. Thanks for having me on to discuss these issues. The Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, the lead organizer for that is Dr. Nolan Higdon, whom I've worked with for years on various things, and Project Censored was a co-sponsor of this event. It was also co-sponsored by several academic institutions. This is an ongoing issue. This is an issue of big tech gatekeeping, algorithmic censorship. We have not been able to get any real feedback from YouTube about what happened, except that they, in true Orwellian fashion, they flipped the script and basically tried to say that Nolan didn't upload the videos or that the videos maybe didn't exist in the first place. They were able to find one of the videos, the keynote, and the more irony there is that one of the keynote presenters was scholar Dr. Safiya Noble, who wrote a book a couple years ago called Algorithms of Oppression about YouTube censorship and deplatforming, particularly of BIPOC communities. And we at Project Censored have covered YouTube algorithmic censorship of LGBTQI communities. That was actually in our Censored 2020 book. Andy Lee Roth and April Anderson wrote a whole chapter on Stonewall. Then they wrote another piece for Index on Censorship. We've been on this case for a while, only to interestingly find ourselves at the receiving end of big tech censorship last fall. This is a specific channel that was only set up for the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas. While there might be a few targets on the right that are censored, they mostly always come after the left. Just recently, Greg Palast is talking about consortium news being censored by YouTube. It's almost every day of the week now you go and see that there's yet another organization, another journalist, another group being deplatformed by these big tech companies. And the bigger question is, how do these big tech private for-profit businesses get control of the public sphere in the first place? Right? That's our big concern at Project Censored, is in a proprietary way, these companies unfortunately do have the right to censor content or curate content. But that's beside the point overall, given that now these companies, half a dozen or so huge tech companies, now have control over many of these internet platforms where most people are going not only to get news and information, but also to get their messages out. And we think that that's a huge problem that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, on Twitter yesterday, that was the first place I heard that Biden was bombing Syria again. And that's true for many people. But what I was impressed with in what you said was that Google actually talked to you. I don't know anyone who's had any success contesting.
Well,
even if you haven't had success, they talk to you and you have a record of the exchange.
I did not. Nolan had a hard time getting a hold of anybody over at Alphabet, Google, YouTube conglomerate. And Alan McLeod was actually able to get in touch with somebody over there. We don't know who, but it was a person. And again, they feigned ignorance, basically. This kind of online censorship, deplatforming, demonetization, and so on from these private big tech companies that all got started with public money. Don't forget that. They all get public subsidies, public monies. They're run amok. And we need a reckoning here. We need to stop this before it becomes even more commonplace than it already is.
Some Democratic pundits and officials have been calling for censorship of Fox News, claiming that they incited the January 6th Capitol riot. And Fox News is, of course, punching back. Here we're going to play a bit of that argument.
After the January 6th riots, mainstream social media rid itself of Donald Trump and thousands of other conspiracy theorists. Twitter dropped more than 70,000 accounts devoted to QAnon in a single day.
And Tucker Carlson is telling viewers that this network, CNN, is trying to force Fox News off the air, which is patently false.
If you have access to information, you can form your own judgments, judgments that are independent of theirs. A free internet is their enemy. The moment they took power, they began a kind of counter-reformation against the free internet. They started the most sweeping mass censorship campaign in the history of this country, and it's accelerating even now.
But while some cry cancel culture, let me suggest a different way to think about this. A harm reduction model. But reducing a liar's reach is not the same as censoring freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is different than freedom of reach.
That's our so-called creative class defending entrenched power on behalf of billionaires. It's not a fascist crackdown on free speech by ruthless and power-mad billionaires. No, not at all. It's just harm reduction, like methadone or Nicorette. It's a way to get better. When they come for you, they will talk like social workers.
There are other options, including the fact that cable operators like Comcast and Charter, which send Fox out to hundreds of millions of people, they can demand some accountability in the way that Facebook and Twitter have done.
Now, you'd think someone somewhere would push back against this. It's everywhere. It's so obvious. But no one in the Democratic Party dares to do that. The last one who tried, just being honest here, was Bernie Sanders. And look what happened to him. Whatever you think of Sanders, we never thought much of him. But for the crime of criticizing billionaires, Sanders wound up denounced by CNN as a sexist Russian operative. The San Francisco Chronicle, according to that paper, Sanders is someone who, quote, manifests privilege, white privilege, male privilege, and class privilege. Yeah, he's a bigot. Take that, billionaire criticizer, Bernie Sanders.
This is a slippery slope. Are people going to say, well, we're not going to sell you a car, Republicans? We're not going to issue you a mortgage, conservatives? I mean, how far does this go?
At this point, there's everyone else in the media standing in crisp formation in their starched matching uniforms, their little caps, patiently awaiting orders from the billionaire class. And then there's Fox News, off by itself, occasionally saying things that are slightly different from everyone else.
Please don't do this. It's stupid.
It's a QAnon conspiracy to take over the state. That's all it is.
Journalism is indeed the first draft of history. And many historians, when they begin to write about a period in history, they will go to the news accounts, because those are the day-by-day, highly detailed accounts of what's going on.
What do you think of the call to deplatform Fox News, which seems to mean getting the cable networks to remove it from what they offer?
I think it's idiotic and misguided. I think censorship is not the answer to these problems. The solution or the antidote to speech that we despise or dislike is more speech to counter it. We need to learn how to agree to disagree. We need to learn how to think critically and independently. We need to learn how to keep conversations going, not shut them down. And we need to resist the urge to tribalize our own communications and silo them in an ever social mediated landscape. And I know that's not popular among some crowds, but if you take a look at the people crowing for censorship, they run the gamut. And it's interesting that you can have Congresswoman Green basically claim that she's the poster child for censorship, that she's being silenced. Even though if you take a look, and I read a lot of conservative news sites, and they're all concerned about this, but they think it's only a problem of the, quote, liberal big tech companies censoring them, which is laughable. Because I counter these people with even more examples of people on the progressive left or further left getting marginalized and getting deplatformed, and they don't want to hear it. To them, it's only happening to conservatives. And this is part of the idiocy of the problem. This is about big tech being able to decide which voices are heard. And nobody appointed Zuckerberg or Dorsey as the czar of information, right? If we have a First Amendment and it means anything, it needs to extend from government to how these big tech companies are basically run by proxy in the public sphere. And that needs to be challenged. So no, as much as I may dislike and disagree with certain things that happen at Fox News, I'm not wasting my energy calling to deplatform or censor other voices. I try to spend my energy getting people to learn how to communicate more clearly and effectively together and opposing censorship in its many guises.
Would you say you're a free speech absolutist?
I'm not an absolutist about anything except not being an absolutist. So I have nuanced views, but I don't really need to be pigeonholed that way. I think that there are already laws on the books that restrict certain things. There are limitations to free speech. Even if hate speech is a gray or nebulous area, it is an area. Inciting violence is not protected speech. Victimizing people and calling for acts of violence against people is not acceptable or lawful communication. So I don't think we need more laws. I think we need more decent people in power that are able to apply these rules and extend them legislatively to the private sector. I do not think that YouTube or Twitter or Instagram, none of these companies should be allowed to censor on the basis of content. I do realize that when I speak this way, that it may appear that I'm a free speech absolutist, but again, with the caveat that I acknowledge fully that there are clear restrictions to things that people should not necessarily be allowed to say. And those are things where people are inciting violence or leading to things that cause people direct harm.
Before you go, Mickey, I have a question, very quick question.
Yes.
COVID-19. We're being told that science rules and that we're supposed to protect scientific consensus, which changes every week. And when we speak out, let's say, about something that is not in agreement with the CDC currently or with the WHO, then also the algorithms do their thing to us. What do you think about that?
I think it's ridiculous, and it's another form of censorship. I see it as quite pernicious and insidious. I know that these are controversial issues. And again, Alan McLeod at Mint Press News just experienced this with a piece that he wrote about Bill Gates. He wrote a piece about Bill Gates and vaccine rollouts and what the profits were behind it, who was benefiting from it, and which groups were sort of being left in the lurch or left behind. And that piece was demonetized. So algorithmically, he was targeted that way because he was using key terms. But it's as if the algorithms aren't real people and don't bother to read the context of the article. So they don't understand what he's even saying. You know, similarly, I know that this isn't popular at Pacifica, but Robert Kennedy's Children's Health Defense is a resource that uses government documents, CDC documents, WHO documents, public health documents, and peer-reviewed research that's been published to argue about how we can make medical treatments and vaccines safer. They immediately get called anti-vaxxers and flat earthers, which is a propaganda campaign. Kennedy himself is not against vaccines. He is for vaccine safety. That there are some people that will glom onto that and make it sound like he's saying something that he isn't is part of the problem of our propaganda system and a lack of critical thinking and discourse. And it's a lack of tolerance to have these open discussions. Science isn't a thing like scientism. It's not something to be worshipped. Scientific methodology is just that. It's a method of constantly questioning, constantly looking at evidence, and reforming the way we see the world based on transparently sourced evidence. And we can't do that process if we have people and we have powerful institutions trying to shut down people that ask legitimate questions. And I want to be very careful with this, because there is a certain way that legitimacy can be established by transparently sourcing the nature of the questions. And I think that we see that among some people in our society. Are there other people that, you know, use this opportunity to wildly speculate and cast aspersions and say things that are not proven? Yes. Is that a problem? Yes. But we have to be very careful, I think, about how we get to decide who gets a say and who doesn't in the public sphere. Because often, especially in terms of scientific advancement, it's some people that are saying very wildly unpopular things that history proves later to be true or to be right or to be more accurate than they were given credit for at the time. And I think that's what it means to respect the scientific methodological process. I'm sure listeners out there are going to be calling the stations complaining, pretending that I'm an anti-vax person or something else just because I have the temerity to talk about this in an open way. But I think that there's a lot of other people that share this opinion that are just too afraid to talk about it because they get tagged very quickly with negative labels. And I think that's part of the problem, is our public discourse lacks critical thought, it lacks critical assessment, and it also lacks compassion for people that have different views and different beliefs. And I think that that's a real crisis for all of us as the human species. And so I would hope that we'd be able to develop a communication system that does allow for reasoned questioning and challenges, but at the same time also acknowledges when there is a consensus around certain topics, but one that always leaves the door open for future possibilities. And I think when we really get into the weeds and start trying to micromanage the kinds of questions people ask in the classroom, and we conflate it with opinions they may have out of the classroom, I think we're on a slippery slope toward a more techno-fascist and totalitarian society. I use the term techno-fascism purposely because I think that there is a degree, a shaded degree of that actually happening among these major tech overlords to try to curate discussion and debate, particularly in ways that goes against the capitalist system. And anybody that wants to pretend like Big Pharma isn't deeply interconnected to the capitalist system probably needs to be checked out for being disconnected with reality. So I think that there is room to ask legitimate questions without making blanket statements that all vaccines are bad and all vaccines are good and so forth. For example, in California, you know, a vast majority, 9 of 10 who opposed SB 277 for mandatory vaccination and connected to public education were only opposed to the mandatory element because they wanted to confirm with their physicians what was best for their families. And 9 of 10 people that opposed SB 277 actually were pro-vaccine and had their children almost entirely vaccinated, with the exception or 1 or 2 of CDC scheduled shots that were delayed or postponed because of personal health issues. You don't see that kind of nuanced reporting in the corporate press because they're beholden to big pharma interests and because nuance doesn't sell. It's not sexy. The news media has done a horrible job by dividing the country, by splitting people into factions, and it doesn't need to be that way. And I think that education can go a long way to change people's minds. And I don't mean propaganda. I mean further exposing people to transparently sourced facts as evidence for certain positions. And I think it's also important to remember that we should be very careful about demonizing other people's intentions. Most people really do have good intentions or are well-intentioned about the things that they're putting forward. And if we close down avenues of communication, we don't really get an even or fair opportunity to change each other's minds. And we don't get an opportunity to think more critically about ourselves and our own positions in the world. And, you know, again, I know people listening to this may turn this around and claim any number of things that they think about me, but I would challenge them to invite me to a public conversation about it to find out what I actually think about it so that they don't twist and turn it into something for their own agendas.
Okay, listeners, don't cancel Mickey Huff.
Yeah, yeah, hopefully not.
Mickey Huff, thank you for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Baby, do you understand me now? Sometimes I feel a little mad. Don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Now, here's Nick Espinoza, chief security fanatic at Security Fanatics, and producer of the Pacifica podcast, Nick's Nerd News, on Amazon surveillance.
Today we're talking about Amazon, and I want to start this off with a story that was published in May of 2018. And we're going to be talking about a woman named Danielle from Portland, Oregon, and her husband. And this is their story. They were at home, and they received a call from one of the husband's employees in Seattle, who basically said, you need to unplug your Amazon Echo now. It has been hacked. And Danielle said, what are you talking about? And he said, I just received a recording from you, basically from your husband. And she said, no, you didn't. And he said, yes, I did. You're talking about hardwood floors. And she said, oh, my God. And they unplugged their Amazon Echo and they called Amazon about this. Amazon being basically very secretive about these kinds of things, and this is their standard. When this came to light, they made a statement about this incident, and I quote, Echo woke up due to a word in background conversation sounding like its trigger word. I'm not going to say that word because it will trigger yours. Then the subsequent conversation was heard as send message request, at which point the Echo said out loud, to whom? At which point the background conversation was interpreted as a name in the customer's contact list. The Echo then asked out loud, contact name, right? The Echo then interpreted background conversation as right. And as unlikely as this string of events is, we are evaluating options to make this case even less likely. That's right. According to Amazon's official statement, at least 5 times in a row, their Amazon Echo heard a background conversation and misconstrued it as very specific directives. What this underscores is that we find our Amazon Echoes convenient, but the trade-off here is the constant surveillance. And consider just how massive Amazon is in terms of the tens of millions of devices that they have sold us. We're talking about smart home devices like the Echo that have microphones, although many have cameras and microphones on those models, smart doorbells with microphones and cameras known as Ring, the Ring doorbell, and now a wearable fitness band known as the Amazon Halo, and on and on and on. And these devices may make life easier, but let's explore just exactly what we're giving up here, our privacy and a whole lot of our data. Now, the Amazon Echo is always on and listening in your home. Now, think about that. It has to in order to hear its trigger conversation, or rather its trigger word to get it going. And so think about all the conversations you've had within earshot of one of these devices, the arguments, the intimate moments, the discussion about your finances. You just giving your credit card number over the phone to the local pizza place, and on and on and on. Now, according to a Bloomberg article, Amazon employs thousands of people around the world to help improve the Echo's digital assistant powering on this line of speakers. The team listens to voice recordings captured in Echo owners' homes and offices. These recordings are then transcribed, annotated, and fed back into the software as part of an effort to eliminate gaps in the Echo's understanding of human speech and help it respond better to commands. Now, Amazon says that they randomize and divorce your information from this recording, but as we've seen with other big tech companies like Google, for example, that isn't always the case, and I was unable to find a third-party independent audit result of that claim that actually confirms what Amazon is saying. And that brings us to the Ring doorbell, because according to whistleblowers talking to The Intercept just prior to its acquisition by Amazon, Ring was playing fast and loose with their customer data. They were not using any encryption on the millions of doorbell videos they were storing, your doorbell videos, and they were letting executives and foreign workers access your video footage at will. So in other words, if that executive wanted to see your footage, they could go directly to your doorbell. They knew who you were, given all of the information you gave Ring. And it doesn't seem that Amazon has changed much of this game, because now Amazon Ring has a new best friend, and that's over 5,000 local and federal law enforcement agencies. Your Ring doorbell is helping to create the largest surveillance network in the world that is accessible to the police essentially without your permission, as they can simply go to Amazon to request that footage, and they've even created a loophole to get around needing a warrant. According to a recent article by Commando.com, and I quote, although police can't demand homeowners to surrender Ring footage without a warrant, they've created a loophole. Some police departments hand out Ring video doorbells for free as long as you hand over your footage whenever they ask. In other words, they'll give you a free Ring doorbell. All you have to do is pay for it with your own footage, and you don't have any say. You cannot deny them. Now, add to this that they are now integrating their facial recognition technology into this, and that becomes even more of a problem. While they've been improving that accuracy, their facial recognition system, known as Recognition with a K, has a high false positive rate. And the ACLU a couple years ago ran all 535 members of Congress against a mugshot database of 10,000 convicts through the recognition. Those 10,000 convict pictures did not include members of Congress pictures. Recognition incorrectly ID'd 28 members of Congress as criminals. And feel free to insert your own joke right here. This is what we're talking about. Their fitness band Halo is another one, capturing all of your health data. But listen to this simple conclusion by the Washington Post in December of 2020 when they reviewed this product, and I quote, "The Halo collects the most intimate information we've seen from a consumer health gadget and makes the absolute least use of it. This wearable is much better at helping Amazon gather data than at helping you get healthy and happy." And think about the amount of health data they are collecting on you that they're going to do God knows what with. Now, in all of the Amazon's cases here, you are actually paying for these products, or you are paying continuously for storage in things like the Ring doorbell. Therefore, you should expect that privacy should be built in as a default. And it's really not. And think about our kids. We've had issues with kids as well. On November 4th of 2019, Ring Doorbell posted to their blog basically the statistics about all of the kids ringing doorbells. And I quote, "Ring doorbells chimed 15.8 million times during a 24-hour period, over six times more than on Thursday, the week before when Ring doorbells got 2.5 million dings." And think about it this way. They were actually able to track it by time. They said that the peak time, the busiest time, was 6:29 p.m. on the East Coast and 6:51 p.m. on the West Coast. And there were more than 5.3 million dings on Ding doorbells around 7 p.m. and on and on and on. There you go. Amazon's massive surveillance state is in your home and your neighbor's home and beyond. And at some point, we have to figure out when convenience simply isn't worth the amount of data that we give up for it. And this has been your Amazon surveillance news of the day.
That was Nick Espinoza, producer of Nick's Nerd News, a daily podcast syndicated on Pacifica Radio. In December 2017, imprisoned whistleblower Julian Assange addressed the Holberg debate in Oslo, Norway, via video link from inside the Ecuadorian embassy where he took refuge between 2012 and 2019. He warned of an algorithmically engineered fake news apocalypse.
This seems to be essential to the topic of manipulation of information. You touched on the topic of artificial intelligence. With reference to Facebook's and Twitter's involvement in the last presidential election in France, you said earlier this year, quote, "Imagine a Daily Mail run by essentially artificial intelligence. What does that look like when there's only the Daily Mail worldwide? That's what Facebook and Twitter will shift into," end quote. So could you explore that a little bit more? How big is this threat and what can be done about the risks associated with artificial intelligence in terms of manipulation of information and propaganda?
It's overwhelmingly the biggest threat to humanity. It's a much bigger threat than climate change. Artificial intelligence means, look, I've met some very savvy pathological liars, psychopaths, very, very clever and hard to discern. I'm sure all of you have met one or two of those types of people. Just imagine their capacity to lie and deceive multiplied by 1,000. It's not something that human beings can detect when it is at a certain level of proficiency. So human beings for the last 15, 20 years, we have been documenting ourselves with billions of hours of video uploaded to YouTube with all the thoughts and expressions that we have put on web pages and photo sharing, all the things that we have been searching for, and the photos taken by Google Maps as it drives around streets, our current locations, which is communicated by smartphones, etc. An extremely rich, multivariable description of most of humanity, or at least that part which has any influence on the world. Very, very rich description. That is being used to train artificial intelligence systems. In fact, Silicon Valley, those people who are interested in this type of thing, we've kind of had a model of how it works, what form of capitalism it is. It's surveillance capitalism. Its business is to create so-called free services, bait, if you like your Google search engine, or the free software that Google puts onto Android phones, which power 80% of the smartphones worldwide, and use that bait to collect information from people, what you search for example, and then harvest enormous in some informational resource. In some models, it's a kind of resource extraction that comes in and scrapes off information from Norway, like in other countries, like a giant open cup mine, and collects it in Silicon Valley, and then creates profiles and sells them to advertisers. Yeah, so it's the informational middleman. That's all changing. That model is completely changing. As a result of surveillance capitalism, as a result of harnessing all that information from the world, it's enough to then create and to train artificial intelligences. That's how, for example, Google Translate has been able to come up with 65 language pairs now, and it's getting quite good. It's as good as an average human translator in many cases, and one that can work 24 hours a day, etc. So instead of thinking about Google Translate, think about Google Liar. Instead of simply translating information, it's actually translating this giant repository of how human beings behave into information that can be projected to human beings to cause them to act in particular ways. Google Liar. Now, already that's happening in a more primitive form, which is to adjust the search rankings, for example. Now, as a result of the establishment fears in the United States from this unruly outburst of populism that led to Hillary Clinton not being elected, Google decided to invisibly re-rank nearly all the critical press, the establishment critical press. So both on the right and on the left. So from the World Socialist website, which went down by 60%, to WikiLeaks, which was pushed down by 30%, Intercept pushed down 19%, Counterpunch pushed down about 40%. So that has had invisible effect on the behavior of human beings, just based on what they're searching for. Similarly, if you go to YouTube and you see some video that's recommended or not, nearly all foreign policy critiques that are uploaded to YouTube have been demonetized as a form of economic censorship. Those producers who were producing content that was critical of US foreign policy, they don't get any money anymore. No money from Google. This is much more insidious than the case of someone producing a finely crafted news story that is fake, such as the WikiLeaks documents are fabricated. That was the number one fake news story in the United States, according to a study by Stanford. That fake news story was produced not by some site in Macedonia. That fake news story was produced by Newsweek, and who were subsequently sued, and they retracted the article. So instead of finely crafted false messaging like that, think at a strategic level. We're talking about bulk influence of human beings, because these giant new digital superstates operate at scale. So you can have bulk influence. But unlike previous efforts at bulk influence, for example, BBC or a national broadcaster coming up with a line and trying to culturally influence the entire population or politically influence the entire population, we're talking about bulk influence through mass individual targeting of individual psychology, which has been collected by these giant new AI organizations. So the end result means that humanity will not be able to detect what is happening to humanity, because the lies, if you like, or the influence attempts are so fast and so sophisticated. So that then leaves us into a position where humanity can't see what is happening to it. And if it can't see what is happening to it, then it can't possibly change what is happening to it. It's a kind of a fake news apocalypse.
That was Julian Assange, who remains in London's Belmarsh prison while the U.S. appeals its request to extradite him to stand trial for espionage in the U.S.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from William Binney, former technical director of World Military and Geopolitical Analysis and Reporting for the National Security Agency. Binney, who created many of the data collection systems still used by the NSA, left the agency after, he says, it turned from its mission of protecting the U.S. population to controlling it.
For more than 20 years, I've been warning about the drift of democracies towards totalitarian practices and totalitarian state operation. Spying, what they did fundamentally was start, instead of looking and studying people or groups of people who were potentially planning criminal or other kinds of acts like militaries and so on, or governments or drug smugglers, things of that nature, they shifted from that to looking at individuals. So that meant they were collecting everything in the world on everybody they possibly could. Now, as a part of that process, they had to build large storage devices and they centrally stored all this data. And their entire objective was, of course, population control. They may not have openly said that to you or may not have made that very clear to you, but that's been the tradition down through history of population control means you have to have knowledge about your population, everyone in it, what they're doing and what they're planning as best you can. So you can manipulate it and control it. And that's exactly what's been going on for more than 20 years. And this I started internally in the US government warning about in 2001. And then after they attacked me because they didn't want anybody knowing about this, even internally in the government, they didn't want the government representatives or senators, or they didn't want it well known that they were doing this. And so they attacked me with the Department of Justice and the FBI, and they fabricated evidence and data against me. Because they have the data, what that means is they could actually manipulate it in terms of changing it, modifying it to make it look like certain things are occurring. And they'll put that in sworn affidavits, as they did with the Steele dossier and so on. They'll just lie openly to the court. And the problem is this has gotten so bad. In the 90s and in the early 2000s, they started pulling in industry and tech industries and so on. And eventually they got them co-opted in, and now they're just really one big community of data acquisition and data storage and data study on every individual in the United States and around the world. If you are familiar with the movie Minority Report, where they had psychics that were determining in advance what people were going to do, well, this is really what their objective was. And these big tech companies sell all the data they collect to the government for a profit. And so they're making money off of you just for the work you do. You put the data in the base, you respond to things, you say you like this, you like that, or whatever. And all that information is collected together and it characterizes you as a person as to what you think, how you feel, the things you like, and the things you like to do. What that has done, and you've seen it in this past few years with the Trump administration about how they are trying to manipulate and control the voting. And they do that simply by manipulating what is available for people to see. When you make a query, if they stack the query in such a way that the information that they don't want you to see is at the bottom, and the data they want you to see, which conveys the concept that they want everybody to believe, why, then that shows up at the top. And they unfortunately, returns, so many returns, you get so many options to look at, you never make it through to the point where you can see the things you might have really wanted to see. And so what they're doing is stacking the deck on controlling the narrative so they control what you see and therefore what you begin to think about and the things that you feel exist in the society and how you should deal with them. That's fundamentally the problem with the big techs. I mean, you can see it even now with the shadow blocking. They'll shadow block people who they don't want to have the data seen or see their data, or they will just simply bar them and throw them out of their product. And so they can't communicate using it. Like, for example, President Trump, he had over 80 million followers on Twitter and they threw him off Twitter. I mean, that shows you the arrogance of these people. They obviously are convinced that they will be exempt from antitrust laws and prosecution under antitrust laws with the new administration coming in. So that's the reason they felt they could do these kinds of things and get away with it, because they expect to be protected. And that's that incestuous relationship between government and these tech companies that is playing out. That's how it's turning out. They're planning on controlling the narrative and making sure that people cannot exercise their First Amendment right that way, because they simply bar them from being able to communicate. That's why the antitrust laws first came into being, to stop monopolies from destroying any potential competition. That's what they did to Parler. When people started to migrate to Parler, they shut Parler down. They had to, because otherwise they would lose control. And that's what they really wanted. And unless we can turn this around and have a way to keep getting an informed public, an informed electorate, where people know what's going on and they have the opportunity to see all points of view and then make up their own minds, then we have a truly a republic. As Ben Franklin said, we'll have a republic if we can keep it. And that's really the issue now, is can we keep it? And with the current setup, the way these tech companies are operating, they believe that they know better. Whatever we think doesn't matter. They'll filter us out. They'll chop us off. They'll stop us from communicating so we can't share our thoughts or our ideas or opinions or anything. And that's a total violation. They're scrapping as a constitution. That doesn't matter anymore. When all the crimes that are visible from Washington, D.C., on television, you can see these people committing these crimes and saying, well, we'll let them get away with it because they're part of the us. And so I kept referring to the Department of the DOJ, as I called it, the Department of Just Us. In other words, we, the people of the United States, are not part of it. So we don't have the set of rules or laws that they have. They have a special set, which they never get prosecuted. If you notice, no one has been prosecuted for all the crimes they're committing, like lying to the FISA court, all of that. That never happens. And what happens to the telecommunications company for all the constitutional violations of the rights of U.S. citizens? They get retroactive immunity from the Congress. Why? Because they've committed so many crimes that if they were ever prosecuted, they'd be out of business. So they had to be protected. And that's essentially what's going to be happening here. These people feel these tech companies feel that they are so powerful now with the new regime coming in Washington that they will be exempt from any laws. All the antitrust laws won't be used against them, and we can just watch and see. It's not going to happen. Nobody's going to get prosecuted. Why? Because it's the Department of Justice.
That was former NSA Technical Director William Binney. He is now engaged in the development of Panquake, a social media platform without the censorship and surveillance controls of the high-tech monopolies. To learn about Panquake, see pan_quake.com. And now, speaking of spooks and the spook state, media producers experiencing a new wave of Joseph McCarthy-style censorship include Pacifica radio programmers. For over 5 years, Fernando Velasquez and his production team maintained a WordPress blog, Pueblos Sin Fronteras, presenting real alternative information from different corners of the earth. WordPress, with no explanation, shut it down on May 1st, 2019. The last published post was titled, quote, social media censorship, unquote. Polina Vasiliev spoke to Fernando Velasquez.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacifica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacifica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
I'm the project director of Informativo Pacifica, a Spanish language news program, half an hour long, produced in Pacifica Radio Los Angeles, KPFK, every day.
Fernando, it seems like we're entering a new era of censorship. Is it true or am I just crazy?
Well, those who have eyes, they can see. Those who have ears, they can hear. There is a Cold War, a new Cold War, emerging between the United States and its adversaries, no different than the one that took place for about half a century between the Soviet Union and the United States. The U.S. military-industrial complex and its associate interest groups, they need to have a real powerful enemy that they can use as an excuse to, A, have a social control at home and social control overseas, and justify tremendous amounts of expenditures, financial expenditures, in the military and the intelligence services. And that's what we see now.
The WordPress blog of Informativo Pacifica was canceled without any explanation.
When I asked for an explanation, they told me it was an automatic response by a computer that then I requested I needed to talk to somebody, a person, and then another automatic response from another computer, perhaps the same one, told me they don't really have to give me an explanation. If they say I violated the terms of the contract, That's the end of it. I don't have to have an explanation from them.
What were you publishing? What did you do? What toes did you step on?
Informativo Pacifica was, besides sharing its content with other radio stations in Europe and Latin America and some parts of the United States, also was uploaded to the website pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com. And this blog had pictures from demonstrations. It had videos of demonstrations. It had newspaper articles, interviews from across the pond from Europe, some interviews from Abya Yala, from Latin America. And locally, nationally, we had comments, reports, statements made by Philip Giraldi, formerly with the CIA, interviews with Ray McGovern, formerly with the CIA. We had reports, documents, and documentaries about Julian Assange, Edward Snowden. We had maps, descriptions, plans of the early Zionist dream of the construction of Greater Israel, which in the 1980s became known as the Oded Gidon Plan, thanks to Israel Chahak that took the Hebrew version and translated it into English. And that description of the construction of Greater Israel, basically swallowing half a dozen countries around the current state of Israel, and dominating all the surrounding countries by destabilizing the neighbors and reducing them to their ethnic and cultural composition. Basically, the giant Greater Israel controlling the Middle East, being surrounded by all these little tiny, tiny, tiny republics. The fact that George Bush Jr., after the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, decided to stabilize several of the very same countries that were marked to be incorporated into Greater Israel, well, that definitely was not something that people who run social media these days, they were never happy about.
Wikipedia, supposedly a reputable source, says the Yinon Plan refers to an article published in February 1982 in the Hebrew journal Kivunim, entitled A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. The article penned by Oded Yinon, reputedly a former advisor to Ariel Sharon, a former senior official with the Israeli Foreign Ministry and journalist for the Jerusalem Post. Cited as an early example of characterizing political projects in the Middle East in terms of a logic of sectarian divisions. Wikipedia.
Then just about a day or two before we were canceled, we had President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela telling his story. And I guess we just crossed a red line that we weren't supposed to cross. My limited perception of the human brain is that it is an imperfect machine. When too many people tell you that you look anemic and weak, and very few people tell you that you look good, at the end of the day, you feel sick. When we are surrounded by all these messages, all these images and sounds, information from all these other countries where the United States has military bases, and they tell you this story and that story and that story, and always the country that has been selected to be destroyed, it always has the shape of one single person, whether it's Fidel Castro, or whether it's Saddam Hussein, or whether it's Nicolas Maduro, or one face, one evil creature, one beast, one monster that needs to be destroyed. No one is ever explained that when that evil person is going to be destroyed, millions of civilians, innocent human lives are going to be lost, so the United States can make more money selling weapons and taking advantage, looting natural resources from other countries without paying for it. And that is totally unacceptable. That's what we do, what we do.
Fernando Velasquez, Informativo Pacifica, heard on Pacifica Radio and its affiliates. Thank you.
A blinding flash. flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames. And nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
Lastly, we remember Rwandan gospel singer Kizito Mihigo, who spent 4 years in a Rwandan prison for recording a song about ethnic reconciliation that differed with Rwanda's legally enforced genocide history. Rwandan police apprehended Kizito Mihigo at Rwanda's border with Burundi on February 13, 2020. 4 days later, they reported that he had committed suicide by hanging in a jail cell. Kizito was a devout Catholic, and few believe that he committed suicide. Humusa Bonyamutwa, a Rwandan exile in Belgium, recorded this cell phone conversation with Kizito while he was in prison, speaking on a contraband phone.
Rwanda est devenue une prison à ciel ouvert. À chaque fois que tu l'évoques,
Rwanda is an open-air prison. Each time you bring up the subject of other victims, people who were killed by the RFP, you're labeled a genocide denier. In 2004, I wasn't just arrested. I was abducted and detained for a long time. I was told that I had to plead guilty. They said if I didn't plead guilty, they would kill me.
Mon emprisonnement a deux raisons. Il y a une raison cachée.
My imprisonment had two reasons. There's a real hidden reason, and that's the song I released in March 2014. The song was about reconciliation. I got to a point where I felt compassion for all victims, not just victims of the genocide against the Tutsi, of which I am one, but also victims of other violence committed by the ruling RFP, even war crimes and crimes against humanity. There are many Rwandans who experience so much violence, and it's not yet recognized as genocide. All suffering must be recognized.
If you had the choice to do it again, knowing the risks, would you? Would you write the song again?
Yes, yes, I would. I couldn't help writing that song. I knew the government would disapprove of it, but I couldn't help myself. I believe that sooner or later, that situation can reoccur. The message is sometimes more important than the messenger.
That was Rwandan gospel singer Kizito Mihigo speaking from inside a Rwandan prison sometime between 2014 and 2018. Mihigo was released in 2018, but constant official harassment, surveillance, and pressure to spy on fellow dissidents drove him to attempt to flee in 2020. Masses were held on four continents to remember him this week, and some called on the Catholic Church to make him a saint. That was in memory of Rwandan gospel singer Kizito Mihigo, who died a year ago in Rwandan police custody. To close, we're also remembering South African nationalist, socialist, and anti-apartheid activist Stephen Biko, who wrote, quote, "The greatest weapon in the hand of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed," unquote. Biko died in South African police custody in September 1977. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. Music credits for today's show include "Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood" by The Animals, "Crayon Escazzi" by Philip Glass, and "We Will Not Go Down" by Michael Hart. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Van Garrison. The executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. Learn more and get involved through our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.